Hi there, it's Martin here. I'm in the Showa Kinin Koen. It's the Showa Memorial Park in Tachikawa, not far from Tokyo, about an hour's drive from my house. And I'm just I'm in one of those I can feel a podcast coming on sort of moods again. I'm standing in front of a beautiful field of yellow and orange and white poppies. I'm just basically walking around. I dare say I'll show you one or two of these, even if it's only in a single exposures type episode. But I'm basically walking around this huge, vast amount of these poppies at the edge of like a playing field. So you can probably hear people playing, kicking balls around behind me and that. And generally though, it's, this time of year, it's just coming into the early summer, maybe late spring, early summer. The poppies are out in force. Some of them are a little bit past their best, and there's a lot of buds left as well, so there's going to be a lot more of these blooming in the next few weeks. It's difficult for some people to sort of, when you're faced with this sort of thing, the first thing you want to do is stick a wide-angle lens on and get the whole swooping thing with all of the poppies across the field, but I find that I rarely do that. I generally put the longest lens on that I have with me and pick out little portions of it and make my own pictures from that. Right now I've got the 300mm f2.8 lens on, and I keep sort of dropping the 1.4 times extender on as well, so that gives me 420mm lens. And basically just walking around looking for like single small areas of the poppies to crop out. I'm finding that the yellow and the orange poppies are very similar colour, but obviously the white with the neutral sort of no colour. And if you try to not class a white as a colour, although it obviously is, but basically the white is the one that stands out of the three colours against the nice darkish green background. So I'm looking for single white poppies or small groups of white poppies in larger groups of the yellow and orange, and that basically is what I'm making my little pictures out of. And I say pictures, I'm thinking more like these are like watercolors or that kind of a picture rather than a photograph. And I hope you'll see what I mean when I show you the photos. Anyway, get back to snapping, and I'll speak to you a little bit more in detail about this in an episode. Catch you later. Bye bye.
Welcome to episode 139 of the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. As you just heard, about a month ago I went to the Showa Memorial Park here in Tokyo to shoot the poppies there. I was going to just do a normal showcase type podcast on the activities of the day and show you a few shots, but having thought about it, a lot of what I would have spoken about for this particular podcast was related to how I sort of manually focused on the subjects in a lot of these shots. And as focusing has come up in the forum a lot recently, I figured that I'd adapt this podcast to concentrate on some of my manual focusing techniques a little. This is not going to be comprehensive, and some of what I'll talk about will require special or more recent gear to use the techniques. But this is, it's what I'm doing right now, at least in some parts of my photography. There are a few observations about focusing that I probably should talk about first. For general focusing of larger scenes or snapshots around town, etc., I don't find that I have to take any more care with regards to focusing as just using the camera's autofocus. One thing I do find, in despite of having 45 focusing sensors on my 1DS, I often select the center focus point. This was the same with my 5D and all previous cameras I've had so far. It's definitely not a problem with the 1DS. In fact, you know, I'd say though that probably 95% of all of the photographs that I've ever made have been made using the center focus point. I will sometimes select a different focus point, but only one. When working with a tripod and I want to focus on a particular part of the image, say, you know, I've set up the scene with the main subject off on one of the thirds, then I'll sometimes move the selected focus point around and use that, but that's probably even less than I use, you know, all of them. For wildlife, say when I'm tracking birds across the sky or a scene, I sometimes select all focus points and allow the camera to select the ones, you know, the right ones, especially when using AI servo mode to track a moving subject. This works well most of the time, except when the surroundings are of higher contrast than the main subject, which I find confuses the camera, even the top of the range cameras. And the focus often gets sort of moved back, gets stolen by the higher contrast background, unintentionally, of course. When this happens, I usually find myself just back using the center focus point, even in AI servo mode. On the topic of contrast, note that autofocus sensors are really just looking for contrast in the scene. If you use autofocus with multiple sensors and you can't seem to get the camera to lock on to the point that you expect it to, one trick is to try to just be conscious and line up the focus points, the sensors, with the lines on the subject, any lines on the subject. If there are people in the shot, the eyes are always going to be the best place to lock on to. Firstly, you know, you should always focus on the eyes in most cases anyway, just for photographic reasons rather than technical reasons. The eyes should always be sharp, of course, and you know, if your subject's eyes are not sharp, they'll look lifeless. From a technical perspective, though, eyes are outlined, and you have the darker or different color areas usually in the, you know, the iris. So to make a good sort of contrast, you know, to get a good contrast to lock into, you know, the eyes are good as well. Otherwise, just look for lines of contrast, literally, in your subject. Horizontal or vertical ones work best, and align one of your active focus points with that. And, you know, if, like I say, if you're using all of your focus points, then, you know, usually you'll have little dots or something in your viewfinder that you can see where the focus points are. Just lay those over lines in your shot, and you'll find that you get a lock on much better. This, you know, it usually works, but even having said that, I often just go back to the center focus point. There are some situations, though, where, you know, even autofocus just won't really cut it. What I generally do is, even in those situations, if it's not too dark, things like that, I'll use autofocus to get an initial focus quickly, and then I'll tweak it with other methods. And today I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about these methods. Let's take a look at the first shot of this series of poppy shots, starting with, you know, just to start the ball rolling, with image number 1780. Here we can see a poppy bud that is partially open with the flower about to bloom. Now, I'm going to use a little artistic license here and talk about one technique that I've used for a while but didn't actually use here, so bear with me. Quite often, for subjects like this that are pretty low to the ground, I use an Angle Finder C from Canon. This fits onto the viewfinder once you've removed the normal plastic and rubber eye cup from the back of the camera, and it allows you to look down into the viewfinder from above. You can actually turn it sort of 360 degrees. It locks into place, I think, at you know, quarter intervals. And I seem to remember, I haven't checked this while preparing for the podcast, but I think it actually has little notches there for on the eighths as well. So as you sort of swing it around, it locks in position at certain preset locations. But of course, you know, it's totally free to move around through the whole, you know, a full circle. This is useful in itself, especially as I, you know, as I say, for low work. But the other thing is that I, you know, I sometimes use the angle finder. It has an ability to magnify. There's a switch on the side that goes from normal magnification to 2x magnification. And that basically, you know, for macro work especially, I usually switch to manual focusing, and I'm going to want to tweak it a little bit. And sometimes it's just not possible, and I don't know if this is eyesight, even though I have the camera set up for me to look through and see things in focus with my glasses on. Obviously, you know, my eyesight's probably not going to be perfect still. So maybe that's it. Maybe some people can see better, but I personally find it difficult to really, you know, focus, to see exactly where the focus is, even with a very, you know, large, bright, you know, viewfinder that the 1DS has. And also, you know, the 5D was had a pretty nice, white, bright viewfinder as well. Still, for some subjects, it's just, you know, not that easy to really see exactly where the focus is. So, you know, while sort of trying to mess around with autofocus is a possibility at these distances, you know, I really just think that for a usual macro scene like this, you know, just switch it to manual and go from there. And so basically, you know, when I look down through the angle finder and switch the magnification to 2x magnification, then, you know, you can see a lot more. You can just basically get in there and really just give the manual a tweak, and you know, the manual focus a tweak, and you can see exactly where your focus is. I also find that for some reason the angle finder seems brighter. It just sort of, it's like looking into a different world, like looking into a kaleidoscope, just to some extent. It's a different thing. It's just totally different than looking straight through the viewfinder. If you have a camera with a crop factor, a 1.5, 1.6 crop factor, something like that, then you'll probably find it even better, because they do generally have slightly darker viewfinders. So it's good for that too. But, you know, really right here, what I'm talking about is zooming in a little bit to tweak the focus. One downside to using the angle finder, though, is that obviously when you flick the 2x magnification switch, you're looking at the center of the screen. You're only looking at the, you know, the middle part of the viewfinder. So if your subject is not in that area, you simply can't see it. So that's one major downside for this method. Even when I'm not shooting macro, as I often shoot with wide open aperture lens, you know, my wide apertures, and shoot with the aperture close to or actually wide open, focus accuracy is very important. Especially when I'm shooting at a slower pace where I can take my time on focusing, I tend to sort of take as much care as possible to get it right. Since upgrading to the 1DS, there's one tool that I have quickly started to depend on, and that is the live view feature. This is available on many of the latest camera releases at all levels and across the spectrum, not just Canon. So I won't be reducing the audience to 1DS owners here, but if you don't have one of the more recent generation cameras, just bear with us for a while. When I first heard about this feature, to be honest, I was not all that thrilled. I wasn't interested. I didn't think that it would be useful. I couldn't imagine myself holding the camera out like a compact digital and composing the scene on the LCD. And you know what? I still don't. With the generally better optics and the clear finder on an SLR, I don't think Live View will ever replace that. There are reasons to use Live View for composition and shooting, you know, itself. Say when you are physically, you can't get your eye to the viewfinder, but that's a different topic. Anyway, although I was not enthused about Live View to start with, once I found out that you can zoom the image on the LCD to 5 and 10 times magnification, I realized that there was a tool here that I had not been conscious of until that point. Obviously, if you can zoom in on the subject on your LCD with the clarity of the LCDs these days, you can tweak the focus to make sure that it's exactly where you want it to be. Let's take a look at image number 1782 and I'll explain the process a little more. We can see here that I've found a patch of poppies with some nice white poppies mingled in and framed it up so that there are lots of poppies in the foreground, creating some nice foreground bokeh. And there are orange and yellow poppies with a few more white ones sort of speckled around in the background, creating their like dreamlike backdrop for the image. As the poppies trail off into the distance, the scene gets slightly darker towards the top as well, adding an overall balance to the image. One of the main reasons that I bought the 300mm f2.8 last year was to enable me to capture this sort of image. I have been looking forward to this field of poppies blooming for the last 6 months. To get back to the focusing though, when I first set up my camera, I used the center focus point and I used that to just focus on the stamen, the yellow stamen of the white flower in the front pair of the two to the left there. And then I recomposed the shot as we see it here. If you recall from previous episodes, I have set my camera up so that I do not focus with the shutter button. When I press the shutter button, the camera only takes the light reading. And also, if I'm using an IS lens, then the image stabilizer will also kick in. But there's no focusing done at that time. I have to press the focus button on the back of the camera, press it there with my thumb to actually focus. What this means is that I can leave my lens in autofocus mode, but then the focus will remain unchanged until, even in autofocus, it'll remain unchanged until I hit the focus button on the back of the camera again, which saves a little bit of fiddling around and flicking the little button on the switch on the lens that will turn autofocus on and off. For this kind of photograph, especially when you've focused and then moved, recomposed, you really don't want the every time you half press the shutter button, you don't want the focus to run around anyway. So I find that this works pretty well. If you were doing something similar to this and you're happy with the focus that you gained from the autofocus, or maybe even tweak the focus while looking through the viewfinder, then you could just go ahead and take the shot now. I, however, will now use my live view tool to check the focus and tweak it as necessary. I have set up my camera to go to live view when I hit the set button in the middle of the quick control dial on the back of the camera. This then flops up the mirror and the scene is displayed on the LCD. I have also set up my camera so that it gives me the approximation of the actual exposure that the shutter speed and the aperture will give me, at my selected ISO. And if you hit the info button on the back of the camera, you toggle through a few options, but one is to have a live histogram. So you can also check that your exposure is where you want it to be at this point. The main reason that I'm in live view right now, though, is to focus. So I use the multi-controller noggin thingy to move a small white frame around the LCD. And when I hit the magnify button at the top right on the back of the camera, I zoom in to see the part of the image that was inside the white frame. And I'll be looking at that at 5 times magnification. You can press it again and go up to 10 times, and then again, and you toggle back to the entire image with no magnification. I find that 5 times magnification is plenty to fine-tune the focus, but 10 is a little bit, it gives you more of a view, but sometimes it's just not necessary. If you have a bit of camera shake, you'll see that on the live view. So you might have to half press the shutter button here to turn your image stabilization on so that you can see your subject more clearly, but it isn't always necessary. Once you are in live view on the 1DS, you are actually forced to use manual focusing, but that's all right. I really think that you want to be doing this in manual anyway. So you just then literally turn the focus ring on your lens while viewing the subject on the LCD, and you can control exactly where the focus falls on your subject. On this occasion, as I said, I focused on the yellow stamen of the or had intended to focus on the yellow stamen of the white poppy on the left, and I found when I looked at it at five times that autofocus had actually locked in on the front, the white petals at the front there, which is understandable because there's a nice contrasting line across the top there. So I had to move the focus back into the scene very slightly. And another sort of benefit of using live view is that the mirror is already locked up. So, you know, then once you've got it all done, you've got your focus cock on, then you just sort of release the shutter, and, you know, I was using a cable release, so just press the button, the image is captured, and you're away. This image was shot at 1,600th of a second at f3.2 with the ISO set to 100. So you can tell there was plenty of light to work with. I think it comes across in the resulting image. One other thing that can be a challenge when shooting with very shallow depth of field is paralleling your main subjects. If you intend to focus on multiple objects, then you know the live view feature can help here too. Let's take a look at image number 1783 and you'll see what I mean. Here we can see that I've captured three white poppies in a line to the left of the frame. This is no coincidence, of course, as I was looking for this type of detail. To make this work, though, they all really need to be acceptably sharp. If they're slightly, further forward or further back, then they don't have to be totally sharp, but they need to be acceptably sharp. And as best as I could, I positioned my camera, by moving from the right to the right and left in a way that appeared to make the film plane or the digital sensor parallel to the three flower heads. To make sure that this was really, really true, make sure that they were all parallel, I again used live view and I zoomed in on one of them, and then once zoomed in, just sort of moved with the multi-controller to the left and the right, and basically give myself the ability to check the other flowers and make sure that they were they were not coming out of the depth of field too much. And you can find, actually, when you just a sort of a technical note here, as you do move around this little sort of frame, move your zoom, your zoomed area around on the LCD, it does get a little bit juddery sometimes. The camera's basically processing a lot of data to give you this image, but it works fine, just a little bit juddery sometimes. Either way, I was able to see that I was not quite square, and I adjusted my camera position a little bit to get parallel to these subjects, because I really just want to have them as sharp as possible. Until now, to do this, I would have had to have shot multiple images and then zoomed in on the image after capture. But this is it's a little bit more time consuming, I find, and you end up taking home a number of additional images that you don't really need, and they'd just be eating up disk space if you're not totally ruthless in your deletion policy, and I'm not, I'm afraid. This too was shot at f3.2 with a shutter speed of 1/1250th of a second, and again at ISO 100. Note that this lens can be used totally wide open at f2.8 and still give sharp images, but I really wanted to just literally close down the depth of field just a fraction. Wide open would have been fine probably, but I just want a little bit more there. But I'm talking one click, so obviously it's not a lot. But that was my general intent in closing down, not really to sharpen things up. One last image that I wanted to look at this point is image number 1786. Here we can see that I've focused in very closely on the center of a yellow poppy. With regards to the composition, I've shot this type of image many times, and I often try to sort of include all of the stamen, and conversely though, not go past the edges of the petals, or if I do, try and do it in an artistic way. But having zoomed in on some of my previous shots, I noticed that I really didn't need to include all of the stamen, and in fact, it may have even given me a slightly more dramatic shot if I didn't. So I decided to go in a little closer here, cutting them off just a little bit at the left and at the top there. And that really, I think it worked. I quite like this image. The light levels had dropped slightly as the sky had became a little bit hazy. This was good as well, because it was acting like a big diffuser now. So I was happy enough about that. The thing is, though, this flower was blowing around in a little bit of wind. You probably heard in the recording at the start, there was sometimes a little, just a tiny gust of a, I wouldn't say wind, a breeze. So that was sort of blowing this flower around a little bit. It's not such a big issue when you're shooting a larger sort of portion of the field, but especially at the speeds I was using. But now it's a little bit darker, and I'm in macro, really sort of shooting something very close up. So I was using my Wimberly Plamp, which is, I believe, means a plant clamp, to hold the flower in place just a little. The plamp clamps onto your tripod leg, and you then have like a large clothes peg that holds the flower steady from its stem. There's a hole in the plamp, and it's large enough so that you don't crush the stem of the flower in any way. The stem of the flower fits nicely inside this hole, so no harm is done to the flower. This doesn't stop the flower moving altogether, obviously, because you're holding it partway down the stem. So I upped the ISO to 200, and still at f4, this meant that I had to slow my shutter speed down to 1/320th of a second, which is it's a little bit, even that's a little bit touch and go with a flower that's blowing around in a relatively strong breeze. A number of shots were blurred, but as I was waiting for the moment that the flower stopped, there's a point where it moves across one way, stops before rocking back the other way, and if you watch and you try to catch that, you can often still get a nice image. Obviously, as it does that, your composition is going to be changed. So I was also waiting for it to come back to the same point that I'd set everything up at, so that I could get the shot just how I wanted it to be. There was a number of sharp images, but like I say, a few of them were also blurred. So they're ones for the waste bin. So again, back to focusing, I used live view again here. This time, not to help me focus on a distant subject, but really just to fine-tune the focus in this macro world. Whenever I photograph something, I look for something that is different from the rest of the scene or subject. And here, you'll be able to see those black hairs in the center of the flower, and they stood out in a sea of yellow. So with live view, I could see how much of the surrounding stamen would be in the depth of field. The depth of field preview buttons work. Button works, so that's something that you can use as well. And as I manually changed the focus around, those hairs sort of came into focus. I could see that it was looking good. So again, I just tripped the shutter at that point. The main benefit here is that I was working low to the ground, and I might have usually, at this point, use the angle finder to zoom in and check the details of this if necessary. But I was actually looking down at the flower from almost above, directly above. And so the angle finder didn't really make sense here. I'd have had to have sort of set it up and then swung it around to the left and peered into the angle finder from the side. And that's a little bit awkward, especially when you're as low down as this. So again, the live view just worked well for me here. Note that there is a little lever on the side of the viewfinder on the 1DS that puts a little shutter across the inside of the viewfinder to stop stray light getting in while you don't have your eye against the viewfinder. If light gets through there, it can affect your metering, and also, you know, if you get a lot in, what it can do is cause little ghost images on your photograph as it reflects down into the optics and onto the sensor. So I, you know, whenever I've got my eye away from the viewfinder, I use that little lever to put it across. I used to have to cover it up, and some cameras actually they provide something to do that. You have to cup them over the viewfinder. And some cameras actually don't need that. They close things off in another way, or they're just designed in a way that light can't get back inside. So if you're worried about that, you maybe want to check your own camera's manual. As I say, it's not been a comprehensive episode on focusing by any means. Really what I'm doing right now in some areas of my photography is what I've concentrated on today. Mainly regards to manual focusing and the fine tuning of. I've mentioned other techniques in the past, like using focusing rails for macro work, especially once you're magnifying at more than 1:1 or life size. That whole series was episodes 42, 43, and 44, and I think I talked about focusing rails in episode 43. I've talked about using the back focus button a little as well, and also touched on using AI servo a few times. I will, though, no doubt follow up on this subject again as I notice other things that I find myself doing that might be of interest to you. One or a few last thoughts about focusing, or the problems that some people have before we finish. In the digital age, it's now much easier for us to zoom in right up to 100% and check pixel for pixel if our images are sharp. Some people say that this is going too far, and depending on what you want to use your images for, this might be true. But if you ever intend to sell your images commercially, anything that's not tack sharp will rarely make the cut, especially when you're up against other photographers, because they will almost certainly have submitted tack sharp images. There are always going to be times when you make an artistic decision to include deliberately blurred areas or depict something moving, maybe something like that. But this should be obvious and deliberate and add to the image. If a shot basically should be sharp and it's not, then you'll be at a disadvantage. So I myself suggest that you do pixel peep and check your images for sharpness. When you do so, and if you find that the image is not tack sharp, it's not always obvious what the cause of the lack of focus or the lack of sharpness can be. So focusing errors are much more common than people think. This is something that I want you to bear in mind. One way to find out if you've messed up with the focusing is to check to see if anything in the image is sharp, anything at all. Zoom in on your main subject where you wanted to focus, and then start to sort of scroll around the image to see if anything in either, a little bit closer or further away from what you thought you focused on is in focus. If you can find something like that, then it means that your focusing technique was flawed and you'll need to improve. Harsh, but true. If nothing is in focus, assuming that there are things in the frame that should have been, then this could obviously be something else, probably camera shake, or it could be subject blur if the subject is moving and the rest of the image, or at least parts that were in the depth of field, are in focus. Ask yourself, was your main subject moving the whole thing? Or maybe even were you moving, shooting from a vehicle or something? Obviously, that's going to increase the risk of getting something or the whole thing incredibly blurred. Image stabilization technologies will help here, but only to an extent. The longer the lens, the more likely you are to get camera shake, and you need to compensate for that with shorter or faster shutter speeds. I've been into this a number of times though in the past, so I won't go into it again today. There is, of course, always the possibility that your lens has problems and not, not focusing where you think it is. Your camera thinks it's focusing, it's got it right, but the lens is actually, you know, working on its own agenda, and that can happen. And you know, but to overcome that, or not to overcome it, but to at least to check for that, if you can go back to episode 101 of this podcast, I discuss how to test a lens for such focusing problems. Cheaper lenses as well, they can sometimes just not produce sharp images. You know, totally unsharp lenses is very rare, but you know, the cheaper they get, quite frankly, you know, the lesser quality image that you're going to get. There are some exceptions. You know, some of the 50mm, the 1.4, if you stop that down a little bit, 50mm 1.4 is a nice lens. The 50mm 1.8 is also relatively sharp, and that's literally just $100 or so. So it doesn't always mean that you have to pay a lot of money, but you know, in general, there's cheaper sort of the kit lenses or lower end consumer lenses are not going to be as sharp as your professional lenses. So as long as your lens is okay, though, if it all, you know, and you know that the lens is okay, then anything that where you find a lack of sharpness is probably going to come down to technique. Also note that some camera manufacturers make interchangeable focusing screens for some cameras in their, you know, in their range. It's not always every camera that you can do this, but some cameras allow you to change the focusing screen. And they usually have one or two of these screens that are designed to help you with precise manual focusing. Though this is, it's sometimes at the expense of a slight drop-off in brightness of the viewfinder, so you've got to really want to know that you know, you do a lot of manual focusing, or you're really having problems with this before you change that out. But it might be worth considering, so check your camera's manual or your camera's maker's website. So, as you'll have noticed, we're a little late this week. The main reason for this is because I finally bit the bullet and bought a new A3 Plus or 13x19-inch printer. The printer's not 13x19 inches, it can print on up to 13x19-inch paper. I haven't been able to make much progress on my apartment move plans, which I need to do before I can buy the 24-inch wide printer that I've got my eye on. Basically because I can't fit it in my current apartment. But I was actually, you know, there's a few reasons why I've gone and bought a smaller printer right now. One of them is that I was actually nervous about making the jump from Epson, I've been using Epson printers for many years. And I was, the 24-inch one that I want is from Canon, but I've never used Canon printers, so I really wanted to get, a feel for how good they are before upgrading as well. And also, you know, that, like I say, the apartment move isn't going as quickly as I thought I was going to, so I thought I'd give it a bash. I basically, you know, the other thing is that I wanted to experience the wider color gamut that the new Canon supposed to have, and I'm finding that it has. And it's, you know, my old 7-year-old, I think it is, Epson printer has been doing great, and my initial tests are finding that, you know, I'm still very happy with the images that I've been getting from my Epson, so you know, that's good. But after a few teething problems anyway, I'm now making prints of the quality that I expected, and with a few other gripes, I'm slowly getting used to this the new Canon printer. This basically, though, it took a fair amount of time at the expense of preparation for this podcast, so we're a day or so late. I will be bringing you a review on the Canon Pixma Pro 9500 pigment ink printer in the coming weeks, though, so hopefully that will make up for it. Remember that voting is currently in progress for the abstract assignment, and the voting system in the assignment album at mbpgalleries.com will be turned on until the end of June 1st or possibly June 2nd, as I'm going to be caught up in a few things around that time. You need to be a member to vote, but if you register, then it's very easy to do. So please do come along and take a look, as the images that have been submitted for this assignment are amazing as usual. For now, though, just have a great week, what's left of it, and I'll be back next week with the assignment winners and to set the stage for the next assignment. Bye-bye for now.
PhotoCastNetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere. PhotoCastNetwork.com.